webinar. We are delighted to be doing this webinar series, and this is brought to you by Pacific Gas and Electric Company's Energy Training Center. Today we have Danny Parker and Dave Robinson. A couple of announcements I wanted to make. One was that if your slides are out of sync, send Eric Kaufman an email. So if they're out of sync, it would be possibly because of a slow connection or else because you might have interference if you're on a public Wi-Fi system. Also, we are having all presenters on mute. If you have a problem, use the question bar box. You should be able to see the question option and send us a question. So a couple things about ACI's resources. We've got an upcoming inaugural Home Energy Training Conference next week in Charlotte. The annual conference is in Baltimore. The best source of information on the 1,000 Ohm Challenge is our 1000ohmchallenge.org website, and we offer regular webinars if you're interested in getting more information on the 1,000 Ohm Challenge. Two upcoming webinars in this series hosted by the Energy Training Center will be the Dense Pack Wall Insulation, Part 1 and Part 2 by Jim Fitzgerald in November. PG&E offers a number of free classes. If you haven't checked these out and if you're anywhere near Northern California, they're free and they're either specifically related to how to achieve deep reductions or how to get on the path to deep reductions. The calendar is listed at the top of that email. So this is a statement to just make it clear that what is said during this webinar does not represent the views of PG&E. Wanted to just briefly address the highlights of the learning objectives, which are to address both applications for duct and ductless mini splits, to specifically understand how mini splits can complement other energy upgrades as part of a broader package, to address the challenge of homeowner perceptions, expectations, operational issues that may be key to determining whether or not a mini split application is appropriate or not, and to address what we know and, more importantly, what we do not know about energy use, cooling performance, and peak energy demand of mini splits and cooling applications. So the outline is that I'm doing the intro to the webinar and to the 1,000 Home Challenge. Danny will spend about a half hour, followed by Dave Robinson, and then at the end we'll have discussion and questions. In order to make sure we don't have interruptions in terms of sound disturbance, participants are being muted throughout this entire webinar. At any time, please type in questions and we'll be getting to them at the end of the webinar. So the 1,000 Ohm Challenge has a goal of transforming North American housing stock by demonstrating the potential of deep reductions. We define deep reductions as 70% or greater, and that deep reductions can be achieved typically through the primary keystone of efficiency with a combination of behavioral choices, renewables, and community solutions. The key metric to determine whether or not you achieve the 1,000 Home Challenge is your verified net annual 12 months household or building site energy use. If you have PV, that gives you a boost that actually expands your threshold. If you use wood, that counts towards your threshold, so that would be part of your budget. Each household has its own unique threshold to meet or exceed. There are two options for achieving the 1,000 Ohm Challenge. One's based on where you start and the other is based on where you end up. In terms of where you start, if you've got verified pre-consumption, you can use that and just do a 75% reduction of your annual site energy use. Got to be verified starting and verified ending. If you use option B, we calculate the threshold based on some simple inputs that you see here: climate, house size, number of occupants, and you need to achieve that in and verify your energy use. The next couple slides are going to show what that option B threshold is in a couple different cases. So here you see a slide titled Option B Household Threshold, kilowatt hours per year by end use, a variety of communities in California. The different color of bars shows you either everything else, the hot water allowance, the cooling allowance, or the electricity, or the electric. This is in the case of electric heat. If you use gas or fossil fuel for heat, your heating allowance is double the BTUs. But what should stand out real obviously here is that the yellow bars are really small, and in many places in California, we don't even give you any allowance for cooling. In most cases, and this is a household of three, the hot water allowance swamps the heating allowance. And even though this might look big by comparison, the green portion of the bars, which are in most part for a household of three larger than heating or hot water, that's still only 2,000 kilowatt hours, which is significantly lower than the average California household in terms of a base load. This shows you the cooling allowance for three different house sizes, 500 square foot, 2,000, and 4,000, in climates that are hotter in California. And you'll see the difference in terms of kilowatt hours per year. All of these numbers are pretty low for these communities. That's the whole idea of 1,000 Home Challenge, was we did not feel that the 1,000 Home Challenge would be a 1,000 Home Challenge if we found that there were 1,000 people in San Diego or 1,000 people in Honolulu that already, or 10,000 that already met the 1,000 Home Challenge. So the goal was for it to be challenging everywhere, regardless of where you are, and to some extent be fairly challenging to everybody. If you were to use a system to achieve cooling in California, and particularly if you were to use a mini split, it would only make sense that you're also using that mini split for heating. And yet, in many cases, using electricity for heating is viewed as not ideal from a carbon perspective. This is specific to PG&E's calculator for carbon emissions. But what you'll see is that if you had an all-electric house here, the top bar, or if you had gas, space, and water heating, and if you met the same threshold with the same inputs, which are three people in a 2,000-square-foot house, your carbon emissions based on PG&E's current carbon calculator would be identical. In other words, being all electric would not mean that you're contributing to a greater carbon emissions. And this is not assuming that the household's producing PV. This bottom bar is for the average customer, which the average residential customer includes quite a few multifamily buildings as well. So the average single family or the average household with 2,000 square feet probably is more than closer to 10,000. So what you'll see here is our option B allowance is probably very likely to be a 25% reduction in or a 75% reduction in CO2 emissions, regardless of an all-electric strategy or a gas heat strategy. So just want another reminder for those who weren't on the call at the very beginning, if you have problems with the slides being out of sync, send Eric an email, ekaufman@affordablecomfort.org. Now, key questions for 1,000 Home Challenge projects are, well, if you've got low space conditioning loads, what systems make sense? And then what systems are going to respond regardless of the load condition? If you've got a lot of partial load or a lot of moderate heating and cooling. And then most importantly, what systems are on the path to deep reductions? In other words, what systems are going to make it easier to continually reduce your load? And the interesting thing about on the path is many people don't realize they're on the path, but in a sense, every household in North America, every household in the world is on the path to deep reductions. So we all need to be thinking about what technology makes it easier to get there. So first I'm going to introduce Dave. It's been my pleasure to work with Dave for years, ever since some of our early regional California conferences. At that point, he was a cutting-edge, bleeding-edge HVAC contractor who embraced diagnostics and was very, very willing, very interested in doing anything that gave him additional feedback in terms of what worked and how things performed. He more recently has taken up the passion of buying foreclosed homes and loves the fact that he doesn't have to deal with a customer overruling his gut, his intuition, his desire to make that home as the best home he can. So, and recently he's installed quite a few mini splits and been modifying mini split systems to make this work for his application. The first presenter is Danny Parker. Danny's worked in building science for 30 years with a specific focus on monitoring and looking at the detail level of what we can learn by measured performance. And I'm not sure why. Okay, so. And what I think is so special about my opportunities to work with Danny have been the fact that, just a sec here, is that he uniquely integrates what he finds at the micro level and looking at analyzing data, combining that with a big picture of where we're going, and combining very effectively his personal and professional life. So with that, we'll change to Danny's presentation.
All right. Thank you, Linda. Welcome everyone to the webinar. And I want to first describe to you a little bit about what are mini-split heat pumps and how can they be used for cooling in low energy houses, as Linda just described to you. What we're looking at is, what we're looking for is we're looking to see if we can find some kind of cooling technology that might be more ideally suited to houses that are on the way to really reducing the cooling needs in the first place. And the reason why we're showing this to you today is this is one technology that looks like it has good promise that way. So let's see. For some reason here, I'm not advancing slides. There we go. So first, what are mini-split heat pumps and how do they work? And I want to talk to you a little bit about the technology. I'm going to provide to you also kind of a potpourri of the data that we have on the cooling energy performance. And since they're different from central systems, I want to describe to you also how room temperatures vary and what are some of the issues associated with using these things versus central systems. And I also want to tell you about what we know and what we don't know about them. And so we'll just move right into that. And so there are key differences between mini-split heat pumps and central systems. And central system is what you're familiar with, where you have an outdoor unit that's connected to an air handler located inside, in this case, an attic, as you would have in a lot of houses. Some houses in California, but a lot of houses in Texas have this arrangement. You have supply ducts in the attic, unfortunately, because it's kind of a hostile environment. Usually grills supplying cooling to the various rooms. And so you have a lot of losses. And, you know, we spent maybe 15, 20 years looking at how to reduce these losses of these duct systems. Well, mini-splits really get around this by having an outdoor unit that's similar to this outdoor unit in the central system, but it's located right outside the room. And rather than a duct system that moves air, it just has a refrigerant line that goes to an indoor unit on the inside that provides cooling. And then the condensate, or the moisture that's being condensed by the evaporator, is piped out to the exterior. And it's possible to have more, and you'll see this in a lot of houses in the Orient, it's possible to have more than one mini-split per house. And it's also possible to have multi-splits, where you have a single outdoor unit and you have multiple indoor heads, as they're called, which are these evaporators. And so there are systems that have up to four of these. You have a single outdoor unit and up to four indoor units. But a kind of a word of warning on that, multi-splits are generally less efficient than the single mini-splits like this, but they can reduce the number of outdoor units. So I guess for us, we look at this as maybe being a new thing, but around the globe, it's not a new thing at all. There are millions of these in use in Asia, especially, but also in Europe. And they also have some characteristics that are really ideal for low-energy houses. They have small size. So it's possible to get units that are less than 1 ton in size for cooling. And they're also very efficient. Recently, they're inverter-controlled DC compressors. They have very high efficiencies, and they have a variable indoor blower, and they've even got sophisticated techniques in terms of the refrigeration process itself, electronic expansion versus the thermal expansion valves, and high-tech defrost and heating mode. And then they also have a remote control system that allows things like the air patterns to be varied within the house. And you also have this issue of the size. So you can get units as small as 4,000 BTUs per hour, and up to about 2 tons. Whereas it's very difficult to find, you know, central systems started about that size. So this is one system that you're going to be seeing more of in my presentation. This is a Fujitsu system, and it happens to be Fujitsu 9 RLS and the 12 RLS system. It happens to be the most efficient systems you can buy, air conditioning systems you can buy in North America right now. So these have a nominal cooling capacity of 3/4 of a ton and 1 ton. But the amazing thing to look at is the SEER, the seasonal energy efficiency ratios, 26 and 25, and the heating performance, really quite good. And even the EER, the energy efficiency ratio at high temperature at 95 degrees, still 17.3 and 14.5. And then there's been some work done recently at Ecotope where they've actually evaluated these units in the lab and found out that their cooling performance and heating performance are relatively close to what's claimed for them. So I just want to share with you, now we're going to move into a kind of a potpourri of different types of data. And this is courtesy, this data is courtesy Ecotope, and this shows a what's called a ductless heat pump, which is actually a mini split, used over 2 7-day intervals in the Pacific Northwest, where they're predominantly a heating climate, but they wanted to find out during hot days in summer what would happen. And so this is a day where we're seeing the outdoor temperature reached almost 90 degrees, and here's the indoor temperature. It reached 75, and on this day, on July 10th, they didn't. There was no cooling used. But if we move over to this period starting July 25th, it got too hot. They had days that were over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And so you see the heat pump, the ductless mini split, it's power here. But it was actually quite low. If we look at what the total was over a 7-day period, one would say even for somebody from Florida, this is very hot weather, the 7-day cooling of only 7 kilowatt hours. Here's another one, and I want to go through this in detail. But
Andy, could you speak up just a little bit?
Yes, I can speak up.
Thank you.
So starting on July 25th, this other system, again, we have these 100 degree days, and they're trying to maintain temperature. This house looks like, in terms of its thermal characteristics, maybe not as good as the one we just saw. You can see that there's still not, the cooling over a 7-day period was only about 26 kilowatt hours, which isn't too bad. So the another source of some information is the Sacramento Municipal Utilities District in California, SMUD. This just shows some cases where they were tracking a house where they were doing some monitoring, and they were showing the pre-retrofit energy use associated with this house, what they predicted it would be from retrofitting to the mini split, and what they actually measured with the weather patterns in that period. And I guess the key points here, there's not a lot of data they have, but they did see good savings, but at least in one case, some reliability problems, and then some aesthetic issues, some resistance to or concerns about the appearance of the indoor unit that I'll go into detail on a little later. Another project, a very efficient house in western Ohio. It's a very small, less than 600 square foot bungalow, built in 1950, but now super insulated in walls, the ceiling and the floor. It's also being cooled with one of these Fujitsu 9 RLS systems. But they're in a period of time where it was above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. they're only using about 2 to 3 kilowatt hours per day, which is very low in terms of their cooling loads. And I've got a note here. Most of the cooling loads for a building like this, where you really insulate them very highly, are going to be from internal sources like appliances and lighting and televisions and so forth, things inside the house. So this becomes kind of the key issue there. I call this the O'Neill house. It's a no-compromise passive house in Sonoma, California. It's been thoroughly renovated. It's 2,400 square feet, super insulated. It's super tight, 0.3 air exchanges per hour at 50 pascals pressure. It's being cooled by a Mr. Slim mini-split Mitsubishi heat pump, and it provides low energy cooling. But Sonoma itself, those of you know, is not what one would call a cooling intensive climate to begin with. The estimated use was only 225 kilowatt hours, and this data kindly provided by Jeremy Fisher and Brendan Less at LBNL shows the temperature distribution in this site over time. And it looks like they're allowing the temperature to vary quite a bit from winter to summer, but it maintains pretty comfortable temperatures. What I wanted to show, though, was that they're in this particular project, they are monitoring all the various in-use loads in some detail. And this is by month, so each of these bars, you're seeing a kilowatt hour is being used for various things. And this is the mini-split heat pump. So this is winter months. So it's, you know, low numbers, less than 200 kilowatt hours generally. But let's move to the summer, and you can see that these numbers are very small, and this is the lowest number, so no conditioning much at all, but so very little. And in fact, what you see is the thing I was just talking about with the Ward Left house, that plug loads turn out, and the refrigeration and so forth, turn out to be the largest loads in this house, not cooling in the first place. And I just took some data that was provided by LBNL for this house this last summer. One warm period, very hot period in June, the hottest one I could find, the temperature did reach over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And these are the measured temperatures on two sides on the inside of the house in the O'Neill house. And so you can see that this, I've got superimposed on that an 80 degree line, which a lot of people would say if it's warmer than that, it's not so good. But you can see even as it warms up, this house is slow to warm, and it really damps out these high temperatures. So they reached about maybe 82, a little bit more, but there was no air conditioning used during this period of time. So I just find this kind of impressive. This house did pretty well, even in what one would consider a very hot period.
And Danny, that house had one single ductless heat pump, correct?
Correct. It has a single ductless heat pump. So it's the idea that we'll come back to that is it might be possible as you improve a house to get away with using a single ductless heat pump rather than the idea of using multiple mini splits as is commonly done in less efficient houses. So this is something to consider. I want to talk about my own house, which started off as a very poorly insulated house built in 1958 in Cocoa Beach, Florida, and this is what it looked like. It was 1,500 square foot with a pool, concrete block construction, totally uninsulated. And there are a lot of houses of this type in Florida, and the utilities, we know that with a pool, that their consumption, and I have one, is about 20,000 kilowatt hours per year. There are millions like that here. So we started a lot of retrofits in 1989. I'm not going to go through those in detail, but we did improve the house and try to reduce its energy use. And I'm just going to show you some of the things we did. We did lots of different things, solar out water with tankless gas backup, a DC pumped pool, white metal roof, low energy refrigeration to get rid of those internal appliance loads and so forth. And then compact fluorescent lighting, which you can see here, the effect on the heat being released with this lamp. A whole house fan to provide ventilation during cooler nights, better washers, and so forth. And this just shows you, and I'm not going to describe all this in detail, but These are my utility records since 1989 in terms of the electricity used. This is the average for an average house in Florida, pretty high numbers because of a lot of cooling. And this is where I started out after a lot of improvements that I made right away. And then here's my 12-month moving average electricity use as all these retrofits are done. And it drops. And then we did some things like add kids and add 500 square feet that caused things not to go down anymore. And they're fairly stable for a period of time. But then you see here that they've really dropped pretty precipitously in the last few years. And what we've done here is we've gone around to some serious things. One, we added solar electricity, but we also replaced the windows with high-efficiency windows. We insulated the walls, and we added a mini split heat pump that I'm going to describe. And it's, again, the same Fujitsu unit, this SEER 26 mini split with an HSPF of 12. I'm using a single three-quarter ton unit to cool and heat the entire house now, and I've abandoned the duct system, which you see here in the attic. And the interesting thing in this last winter that we had was that I'm now using it for space heating rather than natural gas. This is the outdoor unit on the west side of the house. It offers very quiet operation, and it only used 196 kilowatt hours for space heat for all of 2010-2011. This is its average demand profile over the period. And that's interesting because the mini-split power was only about the same as a blower on the gas furnace. So you have something that provides very efficient operation for heating. That's not what we're going to talk about today, but also we've been putting these they're called hobo loggers. They're little portable data loggers that allow you to track room-by-room temperatures. And so we deployed these in all these rooms, and so we could see how the room temperatures vary throughout the day. And this is space heating, and so this is when there is no space heating. The space is just floating. There's naturally some differences. But here we are heating, and we see some big differences from one room to the other, like the room right directly across from the mini split was quite a bit warmer, and we actually had some rooms that I purposefully closed off here that you can see. You can see that these rooms are actually quite a bit cooler because I closed them off to see how much cooler they would get. So, but anyway, we're going to talk about cooling primarily, and I want to describe to you some interesting experiments we did this summer. I was using the mini split for cooling in this house in Florida all summer long, and this is the measured power, cooling power, so less than 500 watts most of the time to operate the entire summer. This is June 15th through July 16th. And what I did in the middle of the summer is I turned off the mini split here, and then I turned on the central system, because remember, I still have a central air conditioner. And this is the blower power for the air conditioner that you see in green. And then this is the compressor power. So we don't have to do a lot of analysis to tell that, you know, there's a big difference in the electricity use associated with the cooling in these two circumstances. And you also may notice some green spikes every once in a while. And that's where we actually used the air handler to try to even out the temperature distribution in some of the rear rooms. And I'll talk about that a little more later. But look at that plot. Now, I want you to pay attention to the next one. So do you see, this is the measured temperature at a far end of the hallway versus close by the mini split the entire time that it was operating. The same thing that we saw before. I'm going to go back and forth. So here's a mini split operating. Here's the central system. So let's look at it again. So you see the central system right here. So you see, you know, that it is maintaining a tighter distribution of temperature, but it's not all that different anyway. And then here are the relative humidities in the space, and in Florida we can care about that a lot. And actually what we've seen is that the relative humidities are actually a little lower than they are some of the rest of the time when we were using the central system. So I'm going to show you a little bit more on that, but first I want to, oops. So first I want to show you the key thing, which is what was the energy reduction that we saw from using the mini split. So when we use the central system during this period of time, it used 20.7 kilowatt hours per day, and it maintained an average interior temperature of about 79 degrees. The average temperature over the entire period was about 82 degrees. And during this period that you see here for the mini split, obviously power use is a lot lower. It was 8.9 kilowatt hours per day, and we maintained about the same temperature that we did with the central system, even though it was hotter. It was hotter in the period of time when the mini split was used. And so we saw 57% energy savings even in a hotter post period. If you want to farm through this data, it's online and you can look at it at that website. So now I'm going to show you a bit on the temperature distributions during these two periods. So again, here's the mini split in operation, and then here's the central system. And then these are all the temperatures measured in these various rooms. So this is the mini split only during this period of time, and this is the central system. And the blue lines that you see is the thermostat, the temperature that controls the central system. So what you see here is that when the central system is on, it does control the temperature at the thermostat, so it's fairly close. But the thing that no one talks about is it doesn't maintain the same temperature regardless. There are differences in temperatures from one room to the next. We see obviously with the mini split there's temperature differences in rooms too. We would expect that. Here's a room that my son Wade, when he closes his room off, we see that he's the warmest room in the house. And that's a decision he makes when he opens that room up. It's actually quite a bit different. So anyway, just to let you know about that. And then we were away this summer. And so we set up the mini split was used during this summer period, and we did some things like we turned on a ceiling fan to see if that would even out the temperatures, and we see that it did. It did even out the temperatures better than the period of time when it wasn't in use. And this is unoccupied, so you're actually able to see that the temperatures from one room to the next, how they varied, and that under very stable conditions, no occupants there. Now, here's when everyone returns home again. So this is how it varied. So the temperatures went down because we set the thermostat back down. We had set it up by 4 degrees while we're away. And we can see again that my son Wade is ending up with a warmer temperature. But the temperature by the thermostat is really not varying too much from what it was like before. So how to equalize these room temperatures? And, you know, first, one of the things to ask after we bring this up is, how much do we really want to have room temperatures that are the same? And so, you know, this is a topic for discussion, but there's various ways to get at this. One, you could use multiple mini-split heads or multiple mini-splits, so as is commonly done in Japan and in a lot of Asia. So that's one way of doing it, maybe an expensive way. You could use circulation fans like a Panasonic with the Whisper Green ceiling insert fans, these, where air is pulled in close by the mini split and circulated to other rooms from some supply ducts. Or you could use the existing air handler as I did. And if you're going to do that, you might consider replacing a permanent split capacitor motor with a more efficient variable speed one like these Concept 3 motors that are available that show about a 28% reduction in cooling, and it will actually reduce the energy use associated with furnace operation too. And there's another way of getting at this that's even more clever, and that's to use small customized interior ducts, but I'm going to leave that to Dave. He's going to show you all about that. And, of course, everybody wants to know what this stuff costs. So mini splits are installed are typically between about $2,500 and $4,000 installed, but the experience in the Pacific Northwest, where a lot of are going in, is showing that this figure may be more like the mature cost that you'd see. If you're going to use a multi-split like this with a single outdoor unit, then it's going to be about $1,000 additional for the multiple heads. So that may be a cheaper way of going, but again, they tend to be less efficient than the single mini splits. And I guess another thing to bring up, and I think Dave will reinforce this, that cost with these things may reflect their efficiency. You know, that the cheapest units, you make it what you pay for. So that's something to look into. For a low energy house, you really want to concentrate on the better ones. And if you're going to put in, if you're going to go for what I consider to be overkill at this point, if you're going to put in one mini split per bedroom, the cost is going to be probably similar to a central system. It may be, it probably will be probably more efficient, however, because you don't have the duct clauses. And there may be savings from zoning, too, that we don't know much about. We'll talk about that in just a moment. So, and if you, it may be less in terms of the cost if there's not a duct system and you would have to put one in because these don't require that. So this brings up the question, how many are really needed? So a bit on what we know and what we don't know. Well, the best efficiency mini splits can cut cooling needs by 30 to 70%. I feel pretty confident in saying that. They're going to cut your energy use by a large amount. They have high seasonal energy efficiency ratio with quiet operation, no duct leakage or duct conduction, so you get around that problem. And so this idea, you might be able to use a single mini split to provide efficient cooling on for the hottest days, like in the O'Neill house. That's what I think, or in my house. It might, you know, after you improve walls and windows, it might be possible to do that even in a cooling-dominated climate. And in a house that's even average, not so well insulated, it might be possible to use a single mini split that was used for cooling for the hottest days in a more temperate climate, where you have dog days for maybe a week, and you're going to find a way through. You're going to use a single mini split to accomplish that. What don't we know? We don't know what the zoning savings are. And by zoning savings, I mean that when we have these available in different rooms or different heads, we don't really know how much that's going to reduce energy use. But we know that it will probably reduce it by some, because you're going to have some rooms that don't need cooling and they can be turned off. And we don't know as much about the room temperature distributions as we'd like to know. You saw that in my own house and to a lesser extent in the O'Neill house. But we need to know more about that. And one thing that we see from my single case is that it may not be as bad versus central systems to begin with. Also, we don't know for utilities what the peak load of multiple systems are going to be like. So this is something that we don't know too, as well, and that we need more information in terms of monitoring studies. So conclusions. The advantages of the mini split high-efficiency heat pumps for applications in low-energy houses. One, there are millions in use worldwide. They offer very efficient operation. If you choose the right ones, seasonal energy efficiency ratios are greater than 20. They come in small sizes, which is really important. No duct losses, so you get around this terrible problem that provides probably about a 20% reduction in real energy use right off the bat. And zoning might provide a 20% further reduction. We just don't know. They provide good relative humidity control. They're easy to retrofit. There's no ducts. And they're a good retrofit for window units and for central systems. And distribution is important, and so I'm not saying that this isn't an important issue, but how do we get at it? What's, you know, I think a thing is, what's really needed? Might we need, you know, the overkill idea is one mini split per bedroom, but maybe one per floor in a house, or distributed single systems, as Dave's going to show you. And they will be enhanced by good insulation and windows. The disadvantages with them, if you put in one per room, the expense is probably going to be similar to central systems, even though you're going to save more. And you also do have to provide a condensate drain for each head. And some don't like the appearance of the indoor and multiple outdoor units. This is the way the indoor units appear in this artist studio. And then a final thing that some of you that have tried these may already be aware is, the U.S. air conditioning trade may discourage them because often they want to sell whatever they have on the truck or what's in stock at the warehouse. And so, although these are not just made, not just Japanese units, so they are available from U.S. manufacturers too. However, they're not as efficient as some of the others. So anyway, that is my presentation this afternoon. And I'm going to try to go back here to
I'm transferring it to Dave. Why don't you answer a few questions, Danny? Somebody asked the question of what the SEER ratings were for the Fujitsu RLS 9 that you have in your house.
It's a SEER 26 unit, so it's actually slightly more efficient than the best central system you can buy. So there's a, I think the Nordheim system is about a SEER 24, so it's slightly more efficient than that. But I guess something to tell the person asking the question is the real efficiency in your house is probably greater still because you don't have the duct losses. Assuming that the ducts in an existing home are, they could be in the attic or they could be in a basement or in a crawl space, and those are all not as good as not having duct systems to begin with. So,
and how old was your existing AC system and gas furnace, and what were their sizes and ratings?
The existing system is a 2-ton unit. It's a SEER 10 unit, so this should be quite a bit more efficient than that. But if you work out the numbers in terms of what I saw in terms of the change, it looked like I did better than what those numbers would suggest. And that's not surprising given what I was just saying about the fact that you get around the duct losses. Even though we had sealed up my duct system in my central system, it still doesn't get around the fact that you have those conduction losses, and the ducts are typically only insulated to about R5 or R6, and you know, that's kind of the worst insulation that we'd have in any efficient house.
And how big was your existing furnace and your existing AC system, your central system?
The central air conditioning system was a 2-ton unit, and I believe the furnace was a 40,000 BTU per hour furnace. But it, like I said, it wasn't used this last year. And so we saved a good amount of gas. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the best way to go. So you need to look at specifically what your case is, because in California, of course, the cost of electricity is much higher than the cost of natural gas on a heat basis. And so you need to look at that carefully in terms of what the trade-offs are. But if you really improve the building in terms of insulation and windows and so forth, then it may be possible to do what I've done, where you just get along with a single mini-split heat pump, which doesn't use a lot more power than the blower did in the old furnace.
Great. So, Dave, you ready to go?
I think so. Well, welcome, great, everybody. And, gosh, Danny, as great as you make these things sound, I'm wondering why aren't they used more in America? And that's going to be the topic that we're going to deal with here. But before we do, I want to make a story and a confession that will kind of place my remarks in context. We were practicing this last week, and Linda said, Dave, your presentation sounds like a sales pitch for mini splits. And I thought for a minute, and I said, well, yes. Somebody's got to do it. The HVAC industry is not really doing it. They're selling other things. And home performance industry isn't really doing it. So there's a little asterisk right there, you'll notice, and I'll talk about that in the next slide a little bit. But the point is, if you're passionate about something, it's not work. You don't have to do another day of work in your life. And I have become passionate about two things. One is renovating foreclosures, and the other is ducted mini splits. And so if that shows through and it sounds like a sales pitch, it is. I apologize. Next. Just real quickly. I have been a Carrier dealer as well as a Trane dealer, and you know the way the industry works is the dealers are sent on incentive trips, and they sell, and if they sell enough, they get to go to Europe or Hawaii or wherever. And I've been to a lot of places, but I've never even earned 1 point for selling mini-split heat pumps. And I'm just going to let that speak for itself, and we'll move on. Another little story about how I became a zealot and an evangelist is that at ACI in 2009, I believe it was Kansas City, Charles and I were coming home on the airplane, and everybody was excited about mini splits, but there was just a lot of discouragement about that we don't have enough data. We don't have enough data. So I said, Charles, I'm doing a house right now. Why don't I put one in? And so when the wheels hit down, well, I called Gary, our air conditioning contractor, and said, stop the process of what we're doing. We're going to do something new. Meet me out there tomorrow, and we'll design something. So we designed the hybrid mini-split system using ductwork. Half of it uses ductwork, and half of it doesn't. That's the reason we call it hybrid. And we put it in, and we wrote about it here in November of 2009 in Home Energy, and we've converted to that system on the rest of them. So back to the question, why aren't they used more in America? But before we go to that, I want to just say the system is always the solution. You can have a great concept, but if it has to be developed first into great equipment and then into a great system. You've heard it before around home performance. It's never a silver bullet. It's always 1,000 silver BBs. And that's certainly true here. We're going to talk about hot rodding the mini splits. And just like that hot rod there, that needs real free breathing. How many think that that has a standard factory air cleaner on it? I don't think so. So we want to make our units real free breathing, and we need these other items: a real tight building envelope, really good insulation and correctly installed, minimize the east-west sun, minimum ductwork. If you do have ductwork, put the ducts in the envelope, minimize the static pressure, make sure you get the correct charging, and a complete commissioning. And with this package of seven, you can really make the mini split sing. Danny mentioned it. Don't just get any old mini split, because you want to make sure you get the inverter technology. That's where it changes the AC to DC power, so you can have variable speed on both the compressor and the fan. By the way, just real quick, the SEER rating is a linear equation to the utility bill. So standard in the industry is 13 SEER. The unit Danny mentioned is 26 SEER. 26 is double of 13. The utility bill should be half. Ductwork. The less the better. And none is good. That means ductless. Here's part of the ductwork system. Those registers you see on the top are standard in most American houses, at least production houses. They're terrible. Don't use those. Use these ones down here. We call them the curved fin registers. The fins are farther apart, and they're curved instead of just being a flat stamped piece of metal. You'll get almost twice as much air out of them at less static pressure, and that'll be a good thing because the unit will work more efficiently. Here it is on static pressure. American manufacturers recommend half an inch of water column. That means if you've got a hose with water in it in a U-shaped configuration, if you blow on it, the water will come up the other side of the hose a half an inch. and that's how much they're supposed to have. Unfortunately, we've measured a lot of systems, and they come in not here where the yellow is, but more where the orange is, and even on up to where this red triangle at over an inch, more than double of what they're supposed to have. Those systems are doomed for failure from the beginning. But here we are again at 0.5 for the American systems. Fujitsu recommends 0.28, almost cutting it in half. And the systems that I will show you here in a moment, we come in at even less static pressure than that. This is part of the key to hot rodding the system and getting the most out of it that you can. And here it is. This is the concealed unit, and I believe it to be the key to acceptance in the U.S. market. It doesn't mean that it's the only way to go, but it does mean it gets around some of the market barriers. And as you can see, we're looking down a hallway. We've got some ducts going down here with some branches going off into some rooms. This job was still in process. At the end of our work here, we'll put a new drywall ceiling in there. And then, of course, everything is covered up by an R55 ceiling. So even if there was some duct loss, it isn't really duct loss. And here it is looking up at it, looking straight up at it. Somebody could benefit the group by muting their phone. Don't know who that is, but it's coming through pretty substantial on my end. So there's the unit right there. There's the transition, and here goes the metal ductwork down the hallway. Now, by the way, this will come to you, shipped to you like this, to where it would be a side draft unit. We take this piece right here, and we put it on the end, so it becomes a downdraft, or I guess you could call it an updraft. So let's see. There we're putting the panel on the end, converting it to an updraft. Remember, you're going to have a condensate. Danny mentioned that. We really recommend that you run a drain. We always run a drain. We never use a pump. If you're back east or up north or somewhere up on a crawl space, a wooden floor, run it down inside of the house and hook it into a drain down below, or if you have a basement. If you're on a slab in California or Texas or Phoenix or somewhere, run it outside, and pumps will fail sooner or later. Here it shows the beginning of the furring down of the lowered ceiling, and you can see that there's still about 4 inches above the doorway. So we do not get comments about, gosh, it seems like we're going into a cave. We haven't heard that even one time. Here it is looking up against at it again. Remember, smooth, hard pipe, gentle squared around transitions that we have right here, and these minimize the friction and reduce the static pressure buildup, and it's worked very well for us. That's the unit that we use on all houses. It's the smallest one that they make, actually, that has two zones, and it's a 2-ton. And if you look around the neighborhood, you can see that's a 4-ton, that's a 3-ton. And so 2 tons at 24,000 BTUs is oversized. This house calced out at about 16,000 was needed, but the oversize is less of a problem because the unit modulates down to 40% of capacity, so 40% of 24,000 is way less than what would be oversized, and so it really doesn't, the oversized concern isn't as great as with a regular central system. Reviewing the benefits, you have superior inverter technology. That's where you change to DC power and take the cooling down to only as much as is needed. We have both ducted and non-ducted systems, and coming soon, they're already out in Germany and UK, is heating, cooling, and water heating all coming from one unit. Let's take a look at
the Atherma is available in this country now, Dave.
Pardon?
The Atherma is available in this country.
Yes, it's just barely coming. Soon, the Fujitsu is going to be bringing their unit in, and I'm excited to see how those perform. Always one piece of equipment is better than two or three, unless there's that one situation where it breaks down on you right on like Christmas Eve or something, and then you've got three systems down, and so it's kind of a wait and see. It's an exciting time to be in the home performance industry. Let's look at the market barriers. It's loud, that ugly thing on the wall, it only works for room additions, it's too expensive, or I must have forced air in all of my rooms. If you've been around the business, you've heard some or all of those. Let's take them one at a time. My friend Pete was a recording engineer for 30 years, and he wanted something really quiet, so he showed up with his decibel meter, and he walked around and stood right by the machine and down the hallway and in the bedrooms. The upshot is he's buying a mini split. So it was quiet enough for him. Here's the ugly duckling. People say, what's that ugly thing on the wall? And I just roll with it and say, oh, that's the latest, greatest technology. They use that in Paris and London and Tokyo. And that's a true fact. And it's only now making it into our country, and it's going to save you a lot of energy. And all of our clients have said, oh, wow, okay, and just moved on. It only works for room additions. Well, this never was really true, but certainly now that we have small ducted systems, it definitely is no longer true. It's being well accepted by the American consumer, the American buyer. Now, the American HVAC contractor, that's another story. That's a wait and see. It's typically a pretty tough crowd when it comes to change, and the reason for that is that the source where we got most of our information as HVAC contractors was our manufacturer. And of course they're selling a particular product. It did not happen to be mini splits, and so we didn't get information about it. Cost. Actually, what we've found is that comparing it to a regular central system, when I have my foreclosures, we always take out the ducts and replace them. And so if you're going to do that and start from scratch, It turns out to be a little bit cheaper to put in our ductless system with the mini split. If you were going to go to a high performance 19 SEER super air conditioner, then it would be a lot cheaper to put in the mini split. We need forced air in every room. Well, okay. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. Danny's suggesting that maybe you don't, and I agree with that. But if we want to take a judo approach rather than boxing and hit it head on, rather we would say, okay, we'll agree. And so by using the ducted approach that I recommend, we can get forced air to every room. So, high shear, no duct loss, very little duct loss with a ducted system, and we do have zones. Danny mentioned the savings of zones. We don't have it quantified yet, but we have one customer who went all the way through the summer in Fresno and didn't turn on the bedroom wing of the house. So his two-ton that had two 12,000 BTU units, only one of them got used. Well, we don't know how much that saved, but it definitely saved some.
And how hot does it get in Fresno?
Oh, we have, sometimes we'll have even like 30 days or so every day over 100, and it gets up to 105, 108, 107, stuff like that. Sometimes a little hotter. And by the way, all electric means no gas leaks, no carbon monoxide, and so that's a good thing as well. There's the unit that we use, the 24 RML model number there. You see the 24, of course, means 2 tons. We just simply buy from Johnstone Supply. They're a national company. And one thing I do want to mention is that factory-trained installers are essential. Your normal NAIT-certified HVAC tech is not going to get this charged with Freon correctly unless he's been trained to do these. They are different than American systems. Just wanted to underline that. Here's the some details on the ducted system. Use the hard pipe. Keep ducts as short as possible. And we like to mount them on the roof. Less noise, harder to steal, harder to vandalize, harder to for kids to poke sticks in. They call that a backyard blender, rocks thrown by lawnmowers, and this is typical in Fresno. Some areas of the country, you would never see something mounted on a roof like this, and it would look strange. If that would look strange, you can cover it up and make it look like a fireplace chimney or put another type of surround around it. This is what happens if you mount them on the ground. Commissioning is very important. Here we're just checking the velocity of the wall mounted unit, and 761 feet per minute, that's good. That's going to get across a family room and a dining room. Here we are checking the ducts going into the bathrooms and bedrooms. And here it is again. Let's take a look at the four points that I have noted there. The transition here is very important. The condensate drain here is very important. There are the Freon lines going up, and here are dampers on the branch ducts going away. Now, we can mount these things in the attic also. They work, just not as well. And this piece right here is a factory supplied from Fujitsu. We don't like it. We're not going to use it anymore. We like this system here, which we did have to have. We made this ourselves, or made it in the sheet metal shop. So That's really about the only custom piece of ductwork that there is. Everything else is plug and play or buy it easily at the air conditioning supply place. Now, this is something that we developed ourselves, and it's two units in it, both of them ducted. The living area ducts go this way, the ducts to the bedrooms go this way, and they share this 20 by 30 filter box. Just a disclaimer here, this is not factory recommended or ACCA or ASHRAE recommended. It just works. That's another reason why I love being an EnergyWise house flipper of foreclosed homes, because I get to try things, and some of them work really well. Here it is looking up at it. Super easy filter change. We like that. The first thing we do is we take the factory supplied filter out and throw it away and replace it with one about four times bigger. This is part of hot rodding the system. So here's the options of the way these can go together. Single outside unit, single inside unit, as Danny eloquently spoke about. Then single outside unit and multi-inside units, he referred to as the multi-splits. This is what the manufacturers like to recommend. It can get a little bit pricey, but obviously it sells more equipment. Then you can have the single outside unit and the concealed indoor system with small duct systems, as I've been showing. And then, of course, number four would be combinations. And our favorite so far is that hybrid ducted and ductless system. The outside unit serves two indoor zones. The living area is ductless, and the bedrooms and baths are served by a small duct system. And it's inside the building envelope. You notice the blue ellipse at the bottom. We've done, I think, six of these now, 2.5 years, and we haven't received any complaints or any service calls. As a contractor, that's big, and as a seller of homes or a landlord, that's also big. We're almost finished here. I'm going to show you the billing data of one house, but this is what went into the house. You can see that we build a pretty nice retrofit attic at R55. Leakage is really tight. We put the Panasonic ERV in. We're tight enough to where we need ventilation on purpose. This one got an additional 1 inch of rigid insulation, had good windows, not very much western exposure, a 2-ton unit that we're talking about, and there's the occupants. There were only two of them, but shortly there were three, and we will here are their bills. Circled in red are the electric bills for the hot Fresno summer, the months from May to October. Those are very low. They're less than half of what the neighbors experience. So the retrofit, including the tight envelope and the mini split, served these people very well. Now here's another house in the same neighborhood, same size, same occupant load, same windows, same insulation, a little bit different. It didn't have the 1 inch of rigid insulation, but as you can see, those bills for the same months are almost double. And really, the main only difference is the air conditioner. So that's something that I wanted to point out as well. A couple final slides. Some people think that natural gas is the cheapest way to heat, and here we're showing a calculator that I really like. It's by Building Green. You can go to their site and check it out, and you fill in these different variables: type of fuel, type of heating, how efficient it is. Really, our unit is quite a bit more efficient than 225. But so electricity at 16 per million BTUs, natural gas at 19. So that's surprising to some people. One more quick thing is you should tell your utility company if you have only electric heat, because I don't think they actually give you cheaper kilowatts, but they give you more of their cheapest kilowatts that they have. I think it's called the lifeline allowance. here's another thing that we're investigating, and we call this the power jump duct. And what we want to do is use the most efficient unit that we can, as Danny did in his home right there. And then if we have an orphan bedroom, for example, over here that's not getting air, we put this Panasonic bath fan here. We call it a powered jump duct and take air over here. We're doing that very well in an 800-square-foot apartment in York, Nebraska. And Andrew and Fred are continuing to report data on that. They have a very happy client in there who's just moved in, but we'll wait until we get through a winter and through a summer before we really have too much to say about it. Also, I'm putting one in my home right now to take heat around, and I'll report on that as well. Now, I mentioned that HVAC techs need to be specially factory trained, and we've got a couple of them here, and this is what they had to say about it. So, there you have it, and all of these slides are at greenearthequities.com, my site. There's about 2,000 slides up there. I do a webinar every Tuesday evening, and there's my email, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. And speaking of questions, it's time for questions now. If you have questions for myself or Danny or Linda, just type them in, text them in, and I think, Linda, you have some that have already come in. I'll just kind of turn it over to you.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Danny. One question was specifically related to the refrigerant charge issues. So how do they differ between the system you installed, Danny, with just a single unit, single inside, single outside, versus what you installed, Dave, in your home, the hybrid system, as you refer to it? Well, what's required in order to make sure the refrigerant charge is right, and how does that compare to conventional split systems?
It's a longer answer than I can totally accomplish here. One thing I will say is that American systems are best charged with superheat and subcool kind of numbers. Those are not available, not published, and not used on the mini splits. So weighing in is one of the things, but I don't really want to I don't really want to act like a factory trainer here at this point. I will say that that we can't use subcooling and superheat, and factory training needs to happen, or you won't get the sear that the factory specifies.
Yeah, well, John Proctor said, do you have any information on mini-split performance sensitivity to refrigerant charge levels? Installation and service manuals for many mini-splits have information and primarily weigh the refrigerant depending on your length, your line length, but no information on how to verify that it's been correctly charged. And what are the longer-term maintenance implications? And I know that's an issue that's being looked at in the Northwest, but Danny, do you have anything you want to contribute?
Well, I was fortunate in the case where we were installing my unit to have someone who's really a tech who really is interested in refrigeration issues, and so he actually got the information direct from Fujitsu, and they did weigh in charge based on line length. That's what was done. He also, I think, a triple evacuation was done to, you know, it's very important with the refrigerant being used now to make sure that there's absolutely no moisture in the lines. But in terms of John's questions about how will this be evaluated in the future, I think that's a good question, and I don't have a direct answer for it. One thing to add is the testing that was done by Ecotope, I believe at Purdue, they were looking at some of these issues, and so David Balon may be someone to talk to about that with Ecotope.
Right, or Bob Davies. Actually, we do have the webinars from May that we did, two-part webinars with audio. My understanding is when looking and inspecting the systems that they installed, and they got BPA had a program where they provided an incentive through their utilities, and they did not do anything in the field to verify refrigerant charge, because you can't, the idea was that if you weigh it right, it's going to be right, though a key issue was using the right tool for tightening and tightening properly. And that's why the factory training was absolutely essential. But feel free to check the 1000 Ohm Challenge website for that information as well. But certainly the long-term implications, if you don't get the fittings right, you could lose refrigerant. So I think that's the issue that John's raising is what are the long-term implications? Question came in, is there a limitation on the line length? That would be the Freon line from the outside to inside.
Yes, there is, but it's very long, and we don't even ever get to even the shortest length that they have, which is a 15-foot piece of copper. By putting the unit on the roof, we put it about halfway between both of the indoor units. And so both lines are very short that way, but I don't know the exact length. It's horrendously long. I don't think you'll never hit it unless you're trying to put units on the ground and run up like a 3 or 4 story apartment or something like that.
And a question came in for Dave. How difficult would it have been to place the unit above the hallway ceiling rather than below it?
Well,
and why did you choose to do it below the ceiling? You've done it both ways, correct?
We've done it both ways. In the picture where I showed the transition that I don't want to use anymore, it was indeed above the hallway. The reason that I don't like to put it there is because you're going to have some duct loss by having it up in that hot attic, and by having it below the ceiling, you mitigate any losses that you do have, because even if you do lose it out the duct, it's still inside the envelope, so you haven't really lost it. So just for efficiency is the reason.
Okay. There's a lot of interest in using ductless heat pumps in very high performance homes. Certainly passive house often projects use have distributed mechanical ventilation and then have a point heat source. What are you aware of in terms of the ability of a cooling system to be distributed by ventilation air? Obviously, it's a little bit much easier on the heating side than the cooling side.
You want to take that, Danny?
Well, I think if you wanted to use if you have a pre-existing duct system, it's possible to do that. However, you're immediately going to have the losses that we're trying to avoid, and I think it does depend, however, on the to some extent on the integrity, the thermal integrity of the building itself. And I think the O'Neill House may be a good indicator of that. That is, if your building is very well insulated on the outside and has good windows, and the temperature of the rooms will tend to even out better than it would otherwise. So I don't know if this is answering the question directly, but in terms of if you have a ventilation system in a building, the ability to for the temperatures to be even would depend a lot on the characteristics of that ventilation system and how it was arranged.
Well, I know a lot of ventilation systems would only be using moving about 15 to 20 CFM to a bedroom, for example. Can you get enough, can you address temperature differences well enough in a very, very hot climate to achieve the cooling you need if you had that low of amount of airflow?
Probably not if the building isn't well insulated, because again, you're going to have in the peripheral zones, you're going to have much warmer conditions. So it is going to depend in that case on the building circumstances in terms of thermal integrity. However, a system like Dave is advocating would largely get around some of those issues.
Well, yes, the hybrid, the ducted part would totally get around those issues, but I would also agree with what Danny said. The answer is pretty much no at 10 to 15 CFM. Andrew and Fred's unit in York, Nebraska is using an 80 CFM Panasonic fan, and they are maintaining a 2-degree difference between the living room and the bedroom. But 80 is quite a bit more than your passive house BRV is typically moving.
Another thing to share I didn't have in my presentation is some work that Rob Aldrich with Stephen Winter Associates has done, where they've looked at fairly low rates being passed from one room to the next to try to get good temperature distribution. And they found that that could work, but it only could work if the building was very well insulated. So we end up back there again.
Yes.
That goes back to the question of well insulated has a very different connotation depending on where you're from. Obviously, if you're in a colder place, the norm is for all houses to be insulated, or most of them to be, whereas if you're in a very mild climate, or California, Florida, for example, it's much more common for houses to be uninsulated, particularly older houses. So is the issue how well insulated the house is, or is it what the load is, the cooling load or heating load, as to whether or not a mini split makes a good application? An example would be in a townhouse, a small townhouse in a mild climate. Do you think that would need to be a well insulated house for a mini split to be the first stage on the path to deep reductions?
I think it's both those things that you mentioned. Excuse me, Dave. I'm sorry. It's both those things, I think. Because it is true in milder climates that buildings tend not to be as well insulated, but if you have very hot conditions, then you're kind of in double trouble in that circumstance, because you have very hot conditions, your building's not well insulated, and it does become more difficult to control those outer zones in terms of what their their comfort conditions are like.
I would agree, and just remind everybody that always insulation correctly installed is always the first line of defense and the first thing to do. But before you even do insulation, probably the biggest ignored area is shell sealing. And so I would say a great job of shell sealing and insulation puts you well on the road toward where a mini split is going to work very well. It's those two are on the list of my seven items to hot rod the mini split, and you just can't overlook insulation and shell sealing ever, and think that you're having home performance.
I would agree with Dave completely in that, and I thank you for pointing that out. One thing to add to that is with the mini split, when they're operating, they are very quiet inside, and they're very, very quiet outside, but they also don't exert pressures on the outside of the building shell like a central system does. And we believe this is a reason we were seeing lower humidity when I was operating the mini split versus the central system in my house, because when the central system operates, the returns exert a large negative pressure on the building shell, and then of course in the zones with supplies may be over pressure depending on doors and so forth. So that the central system in some ways exacerbates this problem, and so the mini splits are a bit more forgiving, but Dave's completely right that you need a well-insulated and a fairly tight enclosure to make these things work the best possible.
Now, if someone was to install the ductless heat pump, one per room with a closable door, then it seems like you'd have far more flexibility, far more confidence. If you're an HVAC contractor, that might be the safest solution to make sure your customer's satisfied. But, I mean, what you're specifically talking about is to maximize the energy performance and to have the lowest possible impact on peak. That's where, in both of your examples, you're both really coming in with an integrated package to really minimize the cooling load simultaneously.
Well, it might be the way that you would feel confident about installing it, but to me it seems like kind of a financial waste, because I think that certainly given the approach that Dave's talked about, it's possible to reduce the number of these that you could use. And, those resources in terms of the spending can be spent on something else. And I think still end up with great comfort by just defining some reasonable zones within the house, like maybe upstairs, downstairs. And if downstairs is larger than two wings or something and you have dedicated systems operating those, that would certainly be better than something where you say, well, I'm going to end up with six mini splits in the house. So I think that you'd end up with a solution that's going to save on money and is going to allow you to apply that to other things that are challenging within the idea of creating a very efficient building.
Yes, and one of the things that you could spend that extra money on instead of six indoor heads is what we call the return air pathway, or the door bottom grills that are available at Tamarack. And we're putting those into some of our houses now, so that when we have duct systems with supply to the bedroom, we do have a return air pathway to come back to that return located in the hallway.
Well, one comment that was made by Greg Petrick from NYSERDA was that programs often promote duct leakage reductions, and they would not even have a measure of ductless as an option within the program. So his comment was, this is a heavy lift to overcome, but glad that, in particular, Dave, Danny, you're promoting an alternative.
Well, that's another interesting facet of this is, we end up spending a lot of effort to seal duct systems, and we have successfully for years now, and that's important for central systems. But this might be a way for us to get around that and apply those like that money to be able to apply that to the expense of the tailored mini splits solution that might work quite a bit better. And I think that I think it is. It may be a heavy lift. I think because it's quite different than what everyone's accustomed to, which I believe probably came from central furnaces first developed, and cooling was added by just adding cooling stacks to those systems, and that's how we've ended up with this. But I agree. I think it's and even if you can fix the duct leaks, you're not going to deal with the duct conduction, which is the reason that Dave was working on one of the last systems he described to try to make sure that the distribution system he's using is not in the attic, because it's a harsh environment in the summer for cooling and for the winter and heating.
Well, clearly we need more data. I really appreciate what Dave and Danny brought and shared today. I'd like to give each one of them a chance to make a closing comment and thank everybody for participating. We will be sending out an evaluation for the webinar and including the link to the place where the slides and audio are posted at that point. So, Dave, why don't you start and then Danny do the final comments.
Well, thank you for putting up with my evangelical zeal for mini splits, ducted mini splits. I love working in foreclosed homes where I get to play with the toys. I just think that it's an exciting time to be alive in this industry, home performance, and these are great tools that we have to use. The mini splits, they deserve wider acceptance, and so come on in, the water's fine.
So I agree with that. Thank you, Dave, and thank you, Linda, for ably hosting this. So I believe that these systems really solve several things that we need with very low energy buildings, which is should be our objective in around the world, frankly, with passive house, with zero energy homes. We need smaller heating and cooling systems, and these systems provide that. And they also provide the idea of being able to condition where we live. It's not always necessary to be conditioning the entire building, and so there's a variety of ways that we can really improve the efficiency of the heating and cooling system, and I feel like mini splits offer that. We do have a lot of things we need to learn yet to be able to do them better, but I believe it's just a matter of time before programs like the Department of Energy's Building America program, we're already doing research on these issues right now. So I think the future does look good relative to this.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the support for the webinar through provided through ACI and through the funding through PG&E's Energy Training Center. Thank you very much, Dave, Danny, and all of the participants. If any of you on the call have projects that you're monitoring, feel free to let us know. We're collecting data and actually sharing it through the 1000 Ohm Challenge group on Home Energy Pros website. We do have information there about some of the work that's been done with the Whisper Green fan and just dealing with distribution issues and with point heat sources. So we absolutely are committed to sharing information, learning from our 1000 Home Challenge projects, and moving, accelerating the market forward. So thank you very much.